Ed Zanro on Double J.
We, my family, my wife and my kids and I wanted to have an adventure. You know, I had so many adventures with the band. And in 2012, we finished the tour. We finished, the last date was in Melbourne on the King of Limbs tour. And 6 days later, found myself and with my family on the edge of the rainforest in Brazil, supposed to be there for a year. And you know, life was very simple. There's no Wi-Fi, there's no phone signal. And the kids were young. They went to the little school and I had time to write. And being in Brazil and being in the country, in nature, really, I don't know, there was a kind of a stripping away of all the crap and a reconnection with nature, with the planet. Being in Brazil with the music and going to carnival and stuff, I suddenly felt inspired. I suddenly found what I wanted to write about, which was kind of when people asked me in the last 5 years, what, you know, Radiohead fans like, Ed, what album are you making? I say, I'm making an existential dance record. It's not, but there's seeds in there. There's a truth. And that's what I was kind of aiming at, that kind of what it is to be walking on this planet at this particular moment. And it's my emotional and musical response to that.
Had you ever had a break like that? Because
No. Yeah,
Radiohead are consistently producing, making, touring.
Yeah.
So this is the first time you actually were able to step back and really suck yourself out of that kind of schedule.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, I became, you know, I've been stressing this whole thing of fatherhood and becoming a parent that was such a, I call it, when our son was born, our firstborn was born in 2004, it was like the love bomb going off.
Mm.
And suddenly everything changes. And it's like an awakening in a way. And it forced me to sort my shit out, because there's nothing like a child to shine a mirror on every little foible and every little kind of, you know, and there's a bit of baggage, you know, and I started. And so by the time, you know, sort of by 2012, I'd done a lot of clearing out, if you like. And then that was the first time I had room in my life at a moment, because once the kids are born, you don't have any time. It's kids, Radiohead. And that's how I wanted it to be. And so suddenly it was almost like, you know, taking stock. And it was the initial thing being in Brazil was like slowing down and going like, well, what do I want to do? You know, I'm in this great band, but there was always a hole. And I was trying to figure out what that hole was. Is it me? And I toyed with, well, maybe I should just, and I did toy with this around the time of In Rainbows. I thought, maybe I'll just retrain and do something else. Because I've always loved that idea of doing, there's a soccer player in Britain called Eric Cantona. And he was at the top of his game, played for Man United. He's an incredible player. And at the top of his game, he said, no, I'm walking away and I'm going to do something else. I'm not comparing myself to Eric, the king, but I love that kind of thing, that ability to walk away from something like Radiohead and go, actually, I want to do something else.
I'm actually curious about what you would have pivoted to.
Like, I'm going to make
gardener.
You laugh. No, I tell you what I was into. I was having this, I really wanted to do what's called five elements acupuncture.
Oh, wow.
I'd had this treatment. It's not like traditional Chinese medicine. It's this, of course it involves acupuncture, but it's the old acupuncture. And it's about people fulfilling their destiny. And I come from a family essentially of healers, if you like, going back generations where they're osteopaths, dentists, but going back. So I was always like kind of the black sheep of the family, because I'm the only one who wasn't an osteopath. I was the only one I did this music thing. But I realized within me, there was this thing that I loved. I had this fascination with healing and helping people and doing this. And I had this amazing treatment. So I talked to my acupuncturist in 2000. I said, Jared, I said, because he had this school, I said, do you think I could do this? And he sort of said, you want to leave Radiohead? And I said, I'm up for it. Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, I was trying to figure out what that hole was. And the hole
like
wasn't...
stadiums or needling?
Yeah. Well, I love that. I think it's, you know... Listen, the way I walk through life is I try and see the bigger picture. And I don't want to be defined by being a guy in a successful band. I'm a human being who walks this planet. So I've got this incredible, I've been dealt a great hand, right? An amazing hand. I'm living the dream. But that shouldn't be, you shouldn't be scared to walk away from this dream. If you think there's a hole, and there was a hole, and I didn't know what it was. And actually that hole was songwriting.
Mm.
And that was the thing. And there was I love music. Why would I give up music? You know, so I was just trying to figure out what's the thing missing? And it's this.
Long time coming. It's been a long time coming. Such a long time waiting for it all. Long time coming. It's been a long time coming. Such a long time waiting for.
Songwriting is obviously all you on this. You've surrounded your whole life by four other guys who help you. Radiohead is an incredibly collaborative band. Yeah. But then all of a sudden you step out and as EOB, you're responsible for writing the songs.
Yeah.
Did you have new respect for Tom after you gave it a bash?
Well, I mean, funny enough, people said this yesterday. I've always respected Tom and loved him so much. In many ways, back in the early days, I think it was like I was like his biggest fan. Because I believed in his songs. Even when his songs, you know, when we were at school, I thought he was writing the greatest songs. And they weren't. But there was that kind of... So I don't know if I could have any more respect for him. What I do, I think being a singer, there's an understanding now that until you've stepped up and done that, you never quite know how it feels.
Mm.
But then I don't know how it feels to be the drummer, to be Philip. I don't know how it feels to be Colin. He doesn't know how to... So they're different roles. And I think Tom wouldn't have wanted any other role in the band. And if you want to be a singer, you've got to want that role. You've got to want to step into it. And for years, I didn't want that. And it's kind of by just kind of following my intuition, I found like, actually, I want to do this.
In this night as the north wind blows, trees crack, the earth does howl, everything's falling.
So when you step in to start writing this album, you are in Brazil. There's a Carl Sagan influence as well. What role did Carl Sagan have on Earth?
So there's this. So the working title of the album was Pale Blue Dot, The Pale Blue Dot. And are you aware of this? So there's this photo.
For anybody who isn't aware.
Yeah, I'll explain. And please Google this after I've explained it, because I think these are really important words. So there was a photo taken in 1990 of the Earth by Voyager 1 spacecraft, and it's a photo of Earth, the furthest picture photo taken of Earth. It's literally on the edge of the solar system. And you see this big, big photo, and there's this tiny pale blue dot. There's an arrow there. And that's the Earth. And Carl Sagan writes these words, and they're basically, this is our home, this is us. And it's the bigger picture, because he beautifully writes about every war that's ever been fought, every dictator every lover that's ever loved. It's all happened on this tiny pale blue dot. And that really spoke to me. And I found it so powerful, because the words are so beautiful, but also the message.
Mm.
And the reality of it, because there's no doubt we are living in an incredibly challenging time. The eyes of the world have been upon Australia after Christmas and what you've been through, the bushfires and the floods. And we're in a global climate emergency. And also this system that we've constructed, and I'm not anti-capitalist, but this system that we've constructed is not good for the planet. We can see that. And it's actually not good for most human beings. You know, the truth be told, most of us, and I've had the lucky ticket, but you know, debt, all these things, there's so much unhappiness. You know, why are mental health crises? This system is really hard. So my response to living through this, these words kind of ring true, and the bigger picture is we need to sort this mess out. We really do. And there is a bigger picture. And the problem with, you know, human beings are capable of doing extraordinary things, but also capable of doing incredibly destructive things. And we do inherently feel that we're the center of, can I swear?
Sure.
We're the center of the fucking universe. And we're not. And that's the beauty about the Carl Sagan thing. It puts it into perspective. And these words feel really, really important. And so I read this, and also, interestingly enough, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, which again has a kind of a perspective and a of life living on this planet, all being in the 19th century. But there were challenges then, obviously huge.
Mm.
These words just rang true, and I was going to call the album that, but now there's a film coming out called The Pale Blue Dot that's starring Reese Witherspoon. There's a festival in Britain called The Pale Blue Dot. And at first I was like, damn. But then I thought, no, that's good, because actually there are lots of people who've read these words and go, these are the most prophetic words of our time. And if we and our business leaders and our politicians and all of us read this, this is the kind of perspective we need to have in order to sort this out, because there is a bigger picture. And, you know, we're all, including myself, I'm constantly being drawn into the minutiae and the drama of one's own life. And I'm trying to get back to that bigger perspective. But it's difficult. You know, it is difficult, because when you're in a mess, you're in a mess. Right.
Mm.
But that for me was when I felt those words and resonated with them, that's when the music started to flow. It's like, okay, that's when the words, okay, I can see where this is. I can feel my way through this.
I'm glad you mentioned the flow, because this record does flow. There is, you know, for lack of a better word, it feels like a journey of sorts. And there are moments where there's a particular transgression even within the one song. One of the first songs that we heard from the record was Brazil, named, I'm sure, for the place where it was born. But it kind of begins as this stripped back folk song almost, and then goes into this late night sort of house song.
Yeah.
Where was your head at, and what was the trip that you were taking us on with that song?
It was really that, in my head, it's a bit like when I connect with music and music that's coming out of me, or any music that I love, or, you know, Radiohead's, it becomes very visual. And what I was trying to do with that song, I wanted it, for me, it was kind of, there were several things, but it was about endings and new beginnings. And it could be the end of a life. And, you know, when people die, it's a very sad time. And particularly in the West, because we don't really understand death. Whereas the Eastern philosophy, you know, you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's like, it's just an ending of another chapter, because the soul lives on. And all these things really resonated. This is the other thing. I feel like we're the end of something, and that's why we're at this chaos, and we're at the beginning of a new chapter. And at the end, any change at the end of anything, it's hard. You know, we resist it, because human beings, we resist a change, because we like to be creatures of habit and comfort, and any kind of change we slightly kind of, oh, I don't want to. But there's also then the potential to change for the better. And for me, that was all about that song, and that song visually was about a kind of a sadness and intimacy, the end of something, and somebody, literally I thought of it in a field, like a very green, grassy green field, and very intimate, guitar and a voice, and then the ending of that, and it pulls back, and a bit like you know, on one of those Google Earth things where you pull out, and for me visually it was like pulling out into orbit above the Earth, and it's that kind of almost like a cosmic house kind of thing. And I know it sounds a bit spacey, but
bring it on.
Bring it on, exactly. But it was all about the celebration, and that actually endings, new beginnings, can be amazing things. And I wanted to celebrate that the end, almost like a beautiful new beginning. And that's, for me, that was what the song was about. It was about the end of something, but something beautiful and light and full of love grows from this thing.
Screamadelica, the record, Primal Scream's classic, plays a part in your solo journey as well, doesn't
it? Yeah, that was a huge moment for me because, you know, that was a big record for my generation.
Yeah.
Because we went, you know, 1989 in Britain was the second Summer of Love. The first Summer of Love was in the 67 and the next one was 89. It had a massive effect on culture in Britain. You know, the 80s in Britain was a pretty hard time. Margaret Thatcher, a lot of strikes, a miners' strike, lots of violence, very violent going out, nightclubs, lots of booze, fights. You were, you know, my hometown of Oxford, you'd walk through on a Friday or Saturday night and you kept your head down.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
And then the whole acid house dance thing changed. And it changed overnight, literally. And it had a profound effect on society. I really believe that. And so Screamadelica was the record that sort of was the great first album. I mean, there were great albums like the Happy Mondays, Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches. That was a good record. But Screamadelica had a depth that that record didn't have. And I love the Mondays. But this record was extraordinary, such a beautiful record. So diverse as well. And I was having one of the day, you know, every day I go up to this little hut by the lake. It was very idyllic and there's power. And I was actually writing stuff using computer and doing the kind of electronic stuff because that's where I thought I should be. And one day, you know, every day I'd stop at 11, have a cup of tea, and it was a chance to listen to some music in the context of being in Brazil. And one day, and I listened to loads of stuff, and one day I hadn't listened to this for ages, and I put on Screamadelica. Moving On Up comes on, the first track, and I'm like, get the spine tingle, I go, this is it. And I was like, oh my God. There's something in this music, whether it's the almost like the gospel element of that record, right? It's coming out of the darkness into the light, and that those words, and it was like, that's how I feel.
I was blind, now I can see. You better leave her. I don't mean. I was blind, now I can see.
That's a very, very typical human journey, but that's how I'm feeling right now. And
it's like music of salvation, isn't it?
It totally
is. It literally lifts you.
Yeah, it literally lifts you. And that's what I was seeking to do. And that's the music that I wanted to make that, you know, and that helped me write lyrics, for instance, because I'm not Bob Dylan, you know, and I'd never written lyrics before, but to be able to use, you know, gospel and soul as like my template for, and the language that's in it, then I was like, okay, great. This is where it starts.
So you're there in Brazil, you're listening to Screamadelica. You've got Carl Sagan in one part of your brain and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass sitting on the table. At what point do you start thinking, who's going to help me make this record? Because the list of guests is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, you have Laura Marling, Adrian from Portishead, Glenn from Wilco. Was it kind of a wish list of all the people that you really wanted to work with?
Yeah, so it comes in stages because you don't all get it at once. You kind of go, so then we go back to the UK, I start demoing, and I go into the studio and I didn't know whether I was going to be singing it, and the engineer is like, you can do this, man, and you got this.
So you weren't initially thinking that you'd actually sing your own
songs?
No
way. Wow. No. I didn't have the confidence. I didn't have the confidence in my voice, and it's still something that I, you know, I'm sort of wrestling with. And I think that's inevitable. I think what I need to do is I need to go out on the road. You know, I haven't been out on the road and sung. I've been out on the road and played guitar and sung a little bit, but not gone out on the road and sung. So that's what I need to do. And that's the next thing I'll do. So, and what happens is then you get to a point when you go, actually, you know what? These songs are all right. In fact, I really like these songs. I've got to say, I'm really excited. So I want to work with the best. So the first person I think about is a producer. I want to work with the best producer. Who's my favorite producer? He's a guy called Flood. You know about Flood, right? Yeah. You know, your listeners will, I'm sure, know about Flood.
We know Flood.
You know Flood.
But do you know Flood? Was he a friend of yours? How, well, do you get Flood on your record?
It all goes back to the school gates. His kids and my kids are at the same school.
No.
Yeah, straight up. I mean, how convenient and lucky. We became.
So at the after school pickup, you just bump into Flood?
The first words I said to him, he was working with U2 in the studio, and I was back in the studio with Radiohead. And he was dropping off his son and my daughter and his son in the same year. There were two classes, his son's in the other class. And I said, oh, listen, by the way, mate, I really love that Foles record, Holy Fire. It's fantastic, which I did. It was my favourite record of that year. And he said, it's just pop music, isn't it? And then we started this conversation about pop music of the 70s that we grew up in and loved. Like in Britain, we had Top of the Pops and, you know, and we became mates and our families went on holiday. And I didn't want to put the pressure on him because he was a mate. But at one stage, I was like, how do I finesse this? Or how do I get... So I said to him, I said, listen, what I really need is good counsel. Would you listen to my demos I've been doing? He knew I was working on stuff. And he said, sure. And the thing about Flood is he's a wonderful human being. He's really kind. And being so kind, he can be so truthful. Because that's what you want, right? You want the truth, and he's kind. And so I went to a studio, I started playing it, and I'm flinching, hearing every little guy. And after about the fourth song, I'm kind of like trying to be cool about it. And I said, yeah, of course, you know what I really need is I need to find a producer who can, you know, sonically bring this. And he turned around and said, do you want me to do it? So we're in. And then it's...
See, I still think this is an elaborate ploy, the whole thing. You saw him at the gates. You made friends. Then you went on holidays. You're just biding your time. When do I ask him? When do I make him feel like it was his decision?
I'm not, unfortunately.
I'm on to you, Ed.
I wish I was that Machiavellian. But I just can't be. I mean, like, of course you hope. And listen, I respect the guy hugely. My mantra was work with the best. Mm. So like my house band I started with, Omar Hakim. Everyone knows Omar Hakim. For your listeners, like he was the guy, when you hear Let's Dance by David Bowie, that album, that's him. He's Sting, that first album, he's worked with everyone. I'll tell you the reason I sort of sought him out, because when I was demoing, Random Access Memories by Daft Punk came out. Get Lucky. Who's the rhythm section? On drums, Omar Hakim. Mm. Who's on bass? Nathan East, another legend. So I thought, well, I knew Daft Punk's manager, and I thought, and I asked him, and he said, yeah, I'll put you in touch. So I rang him, and they were up for it, and I'm like, great. Got them over to Wales, where we started the recording, and I had another amazing musician called David Okumu, and that was my initial band for 3 weeks, and we blitzed a load of songs. And then during the process of the record, Laura came for an afternoon and sang a song with Laura. And Glenn Kotche from Wilco is a really good friend. So he came and helped us out when we were going through that tricky period that I call the sonic trenches, where it was like everything was like mud and sounded rubbish. And Adrian from Portishead is an old mate. You know, Radiohead and Portishead go way back together. And it was great getting Adrian down, because he came down for a night and did some guitar playing. It was nice because I was doing most of the playing all the time. So it was nice someone else doing the playing, and he plays killer guitar. And then just in between takes, talking stories and, you know, like musicians do, and checking out his pedal board and all that stuff. So, you know, I'm really blessed to work with these musicians, because they are the best. And what it does is also it raises your game as well, which is really important. And my game was raised, but also I've been out of my comfort zone, which as an artist is really the only place to be.
Yeah.
Because it means you're not repeating yourself. You're kind of like, oh, that uncertainty of like, shit, can I do this? I don't know. Oh, and you do it. You know, it's just that human thing when you just rise to it, right? And we all do it. You know, you all do it in times of your life, you know, especially as a kid.
Mm.
You're constantly doing that. You're constantly out of your comfort zone 5 times a day, right?
Everything's new.
And like, you know, and that's where you grow. That's where you do all your growing. And that for me as a musician is the most important thing, is to keep growing as a musician, is not to rest on one's laurels. And as Nick Mason, the drummer from Pink Floyd, who I know, who says, not to stay at home and feed the peacocks. You know, you got to seek.
Does he actually have peacocks?
I reckon he does.
Probably
I don't
does.
Know. I've had the invite, but he probably does. Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
Are stepping out of your comfort zone. I mean, do you think that was part of the drive to explore these big ideas and to put yourself at the front of the stage instead of on the backing vocals and on the guitar with 4 other guys that you've known for decades now?
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was to feel scared again?
Yeah, definitely. Feel that someone was talking about Nick Cave, and like he with the Bad Seeds, when he plays live, he knows what he's doing. And I saw him recently when he did his Q&A thing.
I said the same, and he was talking about
getting the terror back into it.
And how you needed that.
And you need that.
Yeah.
And it keeps you alive and awake. And also, here's the other thing. I feel like it's a really important time to be a musician. I feel like, you know, I've been doing this now for been in the band for 35 years and signed for 29, signed artist. It feels more important to be doing this than at any time in the last 30 years because of the times we're living through and the way that music of all the arts has the ability to bring people together and help people connect with one another. You know, the connection that we all have through music, whether it's through your show, people listening to the music, but it's also, you know, the live musician coming together. And I feel that's what I want to do. And I've got a real kind of bee in my bonnet about it. That's I want to take this on the road. And we're trying to meet that point live where kind of like rave meets, you know, you talked about an issue before I interviewed about John Hopkins.
Mm.
That idea of trying to do a John Hopkins-esque style thing, but with real musicians. That's where I want to go to, because I feel I don't know why, but I feel it's an important thing at the moment.
Thank you.
There is one song on the record that sounds like you've already stretched it that way, Olympic. It's such a highlight. What happened at the recording of that song?
Well, that was the first one we basically had in the can, and that's with Omar, Nathan and David. And that, for me, is my favourite track on the Rat album. That was the last one I wrote, really, before the album. And that's kind of where I'm heading, I feel, on the second record. And it was just one of those magical moments that, as a musician, I haven't had many of them in the studio, but Quincy Jones has this fabulous expression. This was take four. Why was it better than take three, better than take five, take six? There's a moment when the magic happens. And Quincy Jones calls it the moment when God walks through the room. And it is like a divine thing. It's like a mystical, magical moment. And you're all looking around and you're like, that's kind of like the Holy Grail for musicians. Take four, and if I don't think we did a take five or a take six, because we knew it was just like that was it, and we looked around, and because Flood has this amazing thing as a producer, he doesn't sit behind the glass, he's sitting in the next room, because we weren't in a studio and we did this, we're in a big house with mobile gear, he sits in the room with the musicians, and about, you know, it's a long song about, and we get to the middle A, and I'm looking at him and he's like. You could see his eyes are like saucers, and you go, this is it, this is it. And we're all kind of like, and it's almost like you kind of let go and you just like, you're propelled forward and you're not worried about like mistakes or anything. You're just, you know, it's in the hands of God almost. It's that, it's kind of like, it's a very spiritual thing. And it's funny because for me as a musician, the longer I've done it, it's like those moments are very spiritual moments. And it's like, oh, okay, there's this power. And so that's what I want to... And dance music is deeply spiritual. Lots of music is spiritual, you know. So that's the Holy Grail.
There's a communion.
It's service.
Yeah.
It's like ceremony.
I guess this is, for you, something that sounds like you needed to do, but you're the last of your other band,
yeah,
Radiohead, to release a solo album. Do you feel like this is also a chance for Radiohead fans to hear, you know, really what you've been bringing to the band over the last 20 years?
Not really. I've never had that. I've never had the impulse to do that. I'm quite contrary as well. If people going, when are you going to do it? You doing a solo album? I'm like, I'm not going to do a solo album. I'm a dad. You know, when I'm not on the road, I'm a dad. And I'm quite contrary like that. I would dig my heels in quietly. My whole thing was, you know, if you've got nothing to say, don't say it. Because there are enough records, you know, there are enough records out there with people who don't have anything to say, but they want to say something and they force it and it's just shit. I mean, we all know that. Mm. So there's no need to put any rubbish records out there. And so, in fact, I did the opposite. I didn't allow myself to go there for quite a long time because I was just like, no, because I was creatively very happy being in Radiohead. It can be a very creative place to be. Mm. So I've never felt any need to show people what I do, because everybody has their opinion, and you know, that's...
Oh, they sure do. Radiohead fans sure do have opinions.
Oh yeah. And I know people reduced it to certain things. They go, it's Tom and Johnny, and you know.
Yeah.
And it's not like that, of course, but I don't care. I know what I've done in Radiohead. I know what I do. And I know that it's a proper band as well. So, you know.
I'm astounded when I look at the dates of how long you've all been together. It's a very long time to be in a relationship.
It is, isn't it?
With that many people and for no one to have left.
No.
Johnny Greenwood recently mentioned that Radiohead would be taking this year off for you to all explore your own projects.
Yeah.
It must feel pretty good to have your friends and bandmates each have each other's backs so that you can have this space to explore, you know, your own things.
I think it's really important, and I think that what we realise, I mean, if you look at it, Radiohead we've only made two albums in 10 years.
Mm.
We're not at the most prolific stage of our career, if you like. And I think that reflects the fact the need to, if you play with the same musicians, you know what you can do. And the important thing as a musician is you've got to be inspired. So when you go back and work with those guys in Radiohead, you've got to be inspired. If you've been working with the same people for 35 years nonstop, I don't think there's any way you can be inspired. You know, because there's too much familiarity.
Mm.
And that's why you don't see bands who've been going for 35 years who make, you know, go do band, you know, do album tour cycle. They're not usually making great music after 35 years. So I think our whole view we've always been very, very honest about what we do, and probably our harshest critics. If there's no music there, we won't make another record. If there is, we will.
Mm.
But I don't think, again, like I've been saying, I don't think we've ever been scared of kind of going, well, holding our hands up and going, well, you know, we're not feeling it at the moment.
Own note to fans on your Instagram, you've said that this felt like the start of something new and significant, almost like a calling that, you know, you had to do this. Does it feel like a whole new chapter has opened up, that this is something that you're going to continue to search through and search for something new?
It's a weird thing when you write that in a way, because you know, it sounds such a cliche and it sounds such a, but my whole thing is supreme honesty and supreme authenticity. I think that's the most important thing. And it has been like a calling. It's taken me by surprise. When these songs came out, like I said, I was really happy being a dad. And, you know, I had 10 years ago, I had no desire or whatever. I wasn't feeling it. And then these songs come out and it's like, vroom, you're being pulled. It is like a calling. So I find it it's completely compelling for me. And so, I am, it's interesting because I've had the good fortune of, you know, of with Radiohead, this is how I felt when we started with Radiohead. I had, you know, as a band, we were a little raw around the edges and stuff like that. But this was the most important creative thing for me. And I have the same thing now. And it's taken me by surprise. I wasn't expecting, I haven't felt like this for a very, very long time, because Radiohead is a kind of, it's like the BBC. It's an institution. It's like ABC.
Quote of the week.
I actually nicked that from Philip. He said that.
It's true, though.
It's kind of like an institution. And so, and it's, it, and you, you know, it's great and I love it. But this feels raw and more, this is the place that I'm growing.
I guess meeting lots of different fans and having conversations with them about why my music matters, I kind of learned the painful truths of how difficult people's lives can be all around the world. And the reason music is so important to them is because it's been that thing that's helped them through.
Music makes you.
Double J.